Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the executive editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with the first author of an original research article and the author of an accompanying editorial that appear in the September 2021 issue. With us today is Dr. Natalie Silverton. Dr. Silverton is Associate Professor of Anesthesiology in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah. Dr. Silverton is the first author on an article that appears in the September 2021 issue, and it's titled Non-Invasive Urine Oxygen Monitoring and the Risk of Acute Kidney Injury in Cardiac Surgery. Dr. Silverton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Rathmel. It's a privilege to be here.
We also have with us today Dr. Mark Stafford Smith. Dr. Stafford Smith is Professor of Anesthesiology and Vice Chair for Education in the Department of Anesthesiology at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Stafford Smith authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Silverton's research article, and it's also in the September 2021 issue. It's titled, Could Trended Oxygen Partial Pressure in the Urine Be the ST Segment Kidney Monitor We've Been Looking For? Dr. Stafford Smith, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Dr. Rathmel, thank you. Pleased to be here.
Dr. Silverton, congratulations on the publication of your study. Let's start by setting the stage for listeners. You've developed and tested a novel method for early detection of kidney injury. How common is acute kidney injury in the perioperative period, and more specifically, in association with cardiac surgery involving cardiopulmonary bypass?
Thank you again, Dr. Rathmel. First of all, I just need to acknowledge the team that made this study happen. I worked with a great team of engineers, Kai Cook, Spencer Shumway, Brad Stringer, and Lars Lofgren. We also have a nephrologist and a statistician on our team, Isaac Hall and Greg Stoddard. Acute kidney injury, it's a common complication of cardiac surgery, and the incidence is about 20 to 50% of patients, and that depends on, obviously, the acuity of your patient population and the exact definition of AKI. The need for renal replacement therapy in cardiac surgery patients is about 1 to 3%.
Now, can you review how acute kidney injury is defined and why currently available biomarkers are poor predictors of acute kidney injury?
Sure. Well, the most current consensus guideline for the diagnosis of AKI is something called the KDIGO guideline, and that stands for Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes. So that guideline was first published in 2012, and it was meant to incorporate two of the older classification systems, the AKIN system and the RIFLE classification. These guidelines are based mostly on increases in serum creatinine and also a duration of oliguria. And for the KDIGO criteria, that increase in creatinine is 0.3 milligrams per deciliter or 1.5 times the patient's baseline. And there's also a oliguria criteria, and that is, for KDIGO, that's more than 6 hours of having a urine output less than half a mil per kilo per hour. So there are a number of problems, I think, with using serum creatinine as a marker of AKI. The first is that serum creatinine is really a surrogate for GFR, so it's a functional marker. But a low GFR does not necessarily mean injury. In other words, if we make an analogy to the heart, the cardiac output of a young, healthy person might decrease when they're hypovolemic, but their heart is not necessarily being injured. If you fill them up again, it will function more normally. So the second problem with creatinine is that it's not always the best marker of GFR. I won't get into all the details of this, but we all know that serum creatinine depends on your age, your gender, and your muscle mass and other things. And finally, probably most importantly for this discussion we're having, is that serum creatinine often takes 24 to 72 hours to elevate to the point of being diagnostic. So currently, there are no real therapies for AKI once it occurs other than supportive care and avoiding further injury. So that delay in diagnosis that happens by using serum creatinine, it essentially precludes injury prevention. What we really need is a real-time monitor of kidney injury, something that's going to warn us early on, particularly in the operating room, so we can then intervene and prevent AKI. More recently, there have been a number of new serum and urinary biomarkers of kidney injury that have been developed to try to diagnose AKI earlier than serum creatinine. And these biomarkers are indicators mostly of structural injury. And there are a number of them and a number of studies that have looked at these biomarkers in cardiac surgery and found that they do actually predict future AKI based on creatinine. The downside of these biomarkers, though, is that most of them are pretty new, and most of them are not yet point-of-care tests. So it's hard to make multiple measurements of them in real time. Although there is a new company that has started to develop a point-of-care urinary biomarker, even so, those are, at the moment, still quite expensive, and it's hard to use them routinely in the operating room.
Describe how your new method works and how the device you tested in this study is constructed. And just for awareness, I want people to recognize that you hold a patent on this device and you are commercializing it, just to get that conflict of interest out of the way. But tell us how it works and what it looks like.
Yeah, thanks. In order to do this, I apologize, but I have to tell a little story. And that is, about 5 years ago, I started thinking about a very basic research question that I felt was one of the quote-unquote holy grails of anesthesia. And that question was, at what blood pressure should I run my patient in the operating room to maintain adequate end organ perfusion? At the time, I was fresh out of fellowship, and it was hard for me to believe that we didn't have a good answer for this. In the heart room at our institution, we use cerebral oximetry quite a lot. And I remember one day being concerned that my mean arterial pressure on pump was low, and the surgeon saying, yeah, but the head's fine, it's all good. And at that point, I started to think about maybe the brain isn't always the canary in the coal mine. And maybe if we had a real-time monitor of renal perfusion, sort of like cerebral oximetry of the kidney, maybe we wouldn't have so much AKI. So fortunately, at our institution, we have a really great group of bioengineers in our department. And I remember running into Kai Cook at a Starbucks, and essentially I'd never said two words to him, and I came up to him and I said, hey, Kai, I've got a really big clinical problem. Do you think you can come up with an engineering solution for it? And that sparked a discussion, which then together we organized a work group on the problem, and before long, we stumbled onto the urine oxygen literature. One of our engineers had sort of the brilliant idea of making the device fit just right at the end of the urinary catheter, between the catheter and the collecting bag. And so that way you could, in theory, put it in any patient that had a urinary catheter. And really what we did is we pieced together three sensors into one little device. So the first is an optical oxygen sensor. And the technology is based on something called dynamic luminescent quenching. Essentially, what that is there's some indicator dye on a disc, and the luminescence of that dye is highly specific to oxygen. The thing that I've always thought is pretty cool is that the sensor doesn't actually touch the urine. It just looks at the urine through a little plastic window. So I always thought that was cool. The second part of the sensor is an instantaneous flow sensor, and this is manufactured by a company called Sensorion. And these sensors were originally developed for IV sets to measure continuous flow of IV fluids, and we took it and we put it in instead into our device. And then there's, of course, a small temperature sensor, and that's because the calculation of oxygen partial pressure depends on the temperature. So the urine passes through the catheter and then meets our device and goes through our device and then meets the tubing of the collecting bag and is collected in the collecting bag. And along the way, we measure oxygen partial pressure, instantaneous flow, and temperature.
So what was the hypothesis you tested in the study, and what was the primary outcome you measured?
Our hypothesis was that urine oxygen measurements during cardiac surgery would be feasible with this device, and that a low urine oxygen during cardiac surgery would be associated with the subsequent development of AKI. So our primary outcome was AKI based on the KDIGO criteria. We used both a rise in serum creatinine, and that was defined as greater than either 0.3 milligrams per deciliter in 48 hours or 1.5 times baseline in 7 days. And we also used the oliguria criteria, so greater than 6 hours of a urine output that's less than half a mil per kilo per hour.
So you measured continuous urinary oxygen concentration and instantaneous urine flow in 85 patients undergoing cardiac surgery using your novel device, and it was placed between the urinary catheter and the collecting bag. What did you learn?
Well, first off, we split the intraoperative period into two distinct time periods. So we had the cardiopulmonary bypass period, and then we had the post-cardiopulmonary bypass period. And that latter period was defined by the end of cardiopulmonary bypass to the end of surgery. Interestingly, we found that urine oxygen was lower during the post-cardiopulmonary bypass period in those patients that went on to develop AKI. But we didn't find that difference during the cardiopulmonary bypass period. At first, this was surprising to us. We had all imagined that the insult and the renal hypoxia would occur during cardiopulmonary bypass. But in retrospect, it makes sense to me. So when your patient's on cardiopulmonary bypass, they're cool, often mechanically supported, and it's really only after bypass when you wean them off, and now they're on their own, they're not on mechanical support, they're warm, we're using multiple vasoactive agents to improve their hemodynamics, and it's then where we saw a difference in urine oxygen. So what I just described was actually comparing the mean values of urine oxygen during that time period, but we also analyzed urine oxygen as something as a threshold response. So if you think about the partial pressure of oxygen, let's just say systemic arterial partial pressure of oxygen in your patient, it doesn't really necessarily matter if that PaO2 is 700 or 100, but if you start to drop below a certain threshold, then you start to get consequences. And so we wondered whether the same relationship applies to urine oxygen partial pressure. So in that case, maybe the mean value might not be the best measure. So what we did is we found a threshold of urine oxygen, and that threshold was 25 millimeters of mercury. And for us, for our study, that threshold best predicted AKI with a number of different definitions of AKI. So we used the full KDIGO criteria, meaning creatinine elevation and oliguria, but that threshold also predicted creatinine elevation alone. It also predicted severe AKI, which we defined as KDIGO stage 2 or 3. And then it also predicted a composite outcome of either hospital death or kidney injury at discharge.
So when the urine flow was less than a half a mil per kilogram per hour, you removed the data from analysis, and that happened about 20% of the time. What happens to the technique when urine flow is low?
That's a great question. So our device is non-invasive, and it goes between the urinary catheter and the collecting bag. The trade-off of that, however, is that it's downstream of the bladder, which is itself downstream of the renal pelvis, which is where urine oxygen most closely matches medullary oxygen. So what that means is when there's no urine flow, the oxygen partial pressure we measure is no longer a reflection of the medullary oxygen. And the big unanswered question we have is how low can the urine flow go before our monitor is no longer reliable? The truth is we don't know the answer to that question yet. There are actually models that have been developed in animals with oxygen probes in the bladder and in the renal medulla and modeling how low urine flow can go before those bladder probes become inaccurate. But no one, to my knowledge, has yet done this in people, let alone with our device that isn't even in the bladder but even distal to the bladder. So what we had to do in our study is we had to pick a cutoff to filter out low urine flows, because we knew that the sensor would be inaccurate during really low flows. So what we did is we chose a threshold of less than half a mil per kilo per hour, because this is a clinical threshold of oliguria. We figure that if the urine output is below this threshold, clinicians are already worried about their patients developing AKI. Just incidentally, right now we're looking at just how long these periods of low flow were. So this is some data that we have a PhD student who's working on this right now. And what we want to know is, did that affect the feasibility of the monitor? Obviously, it wouldn't be great if you had an hour-long cardiopulmonary bypass run and two-thirds of that you weren't able to monitor the urine oxygen, particularly if it was 40 minutes in a row. So this is unpublished data, but what we're actually finding right now is that during the post-cardiopulmonary bypass period, 98% of the periods of time where we had this low flow, 98% of them were less than 3 minutes long. So what we're hoping to show is that this monitor may be something that could be feasible to get you data at least every 3 minutes. Although I have to tell you, we're really quite at the beginning of this work, and there's a lot more that needs to be done to see if this is indeed true.
So what did you conclude from this preliminary work?
We concluded that intraoperative urine oxygen measurements are feasible during cardiac surgery using this non-invasive device that's placed between the urinary catheter and the collecting bag, and that a low urine oxygen in the post-cardiopulmonary bypass period might be associated with AKI after cardiac surgery. This is just a pilot study, however, and we got a lot of work ahead of us, and a lot of work needs to be done before we can say that such a monitor is ready for prime time.
Dr. Stafford-Smith, I want to turn to your editorial that also appears in the September 2021 issue of the journal. It's titled, "Could Trended Oxygen Partial Pressure in the Urine Be the ST Segment Kidney Monitor We've Been Looking For?" You do a terrific job of putting Dr. Silverton's article into perspective. You tell readers, as a candidate perioperative AKI biomarker, oxygen partial pressure in the urine measurement contrasts favorably with currently available tools. Can you go over some of the other tools that have been proposed as predictors of acute injury and what limits their usefulness today?
Of course. Well, first, as nicely summarized by Dr. Silverton, we have the traditional gold standard. Current most recent version of that is the KDIGO criteria for AKI, but these are largely based on serum creatinine rise, and as she highlighted, this can be up to 7 days after the insult, and also urine output or oliguria. Both of these are very problematic, particularly in the perioperative arena. 7 days after surgery is clearly way too late to intervene, and urine output has been shown in several studies to be very unreliable around the time of surgery in terms of oliguria having a strong correlation with subsequent AKI definitions. There has been a wave of other AKI biomarkers, as she also highlighted. These have been recognized as substances that accumulate or show levels in the urine or the serum. Examples would be NGAL, cystatin C, KIM-1, and even combinations of such substances being measured, such as the NephroCheck as a tool. These don't seem to have great utility until at least several hours after surgery in most cases. There's other things being looked at as real-time monitors in the OR. For example, some work we've been doing involves looking at the kidney using the transesophageal echocardiography monitor turned away from the heart and towards the left kidney, which is usually visible. And one can look at the pulsatility within the renal artery, and arteries that show a high spike in pulsatility suggest that the kidney is swollen, and high spiked or high elevated renal resistive index values intraoperatively have been associated with subsequent development of AKI. Though this is another interesting tool, it is no more validated, in fact, possibly less validated than the urine oxygen tension in the urinary catheter, as Dr. Silverton and colleagues have suggested.
The evidence to support use of oxygen and partial pressure in the urine as a potential monitor of real-time kidney well-being and ischemia is supported by many years of science. Can you explain the renal physiology and the prior work linking this measure to kidney injury?
Absolutely. First, it has been known since the 1960s that even normal individuals at rest have a very low renal medullary oxygen partial pressure. The explanation for this is challenging and needs to be followed along with a little bit, but if you recall back to those days in your physiology classes when the concept of countercurrent exchange was explained in order to create the urea gradient, which is so uniquely allows the ability of the kidney to concentrate urine. That same sluggish capillary blood flow that allows the deep medulla to have this urea gradient also allows oxygen to escape from entering to exiting capillaries as they go deep into the medulla, these vasa recta, so-called. So what you see is a gradient of oxygen so that deep in the renal medulla, the PO2 values can be as low as 15 millimeters of mercury, even in normal healthy adults. While this has been reported for many, many years, more recently animal studies, including some of our own, have shown, firstly, that urinary oxygen partial pressure, also known as PuO2, is also low at rest and tracks up and down with changes in renal medullary oxygen partial pressure. So in a porcine heart surgery model, we, in a previous study, noticed that during cardiopulmonary bypass, medullary oxygen partial pressure declines at the onset of cardiopulmonary bypass. And this persists throughout cardiopulmonary bypass with some level of recovery after cardiopulmonary bypass. So the tracking of urine partial pressure of oxygen as a surrogate for renal medullary partial pressure of oxygen fits in terms of its logic. It's been looked at, in addition to the Sillerton study, in other human cardiac surgery studies, and in a fairly consistent way in each of these, low urinary oxygen partial pressures for longer periods of time were more associated with the subsequent development of acute kidney injury using various creatinine-based criteria. There have been a handful of studies that have looked at the same question in non-cardiac studies, but there really is insufficient data to be very confident of the same observation in those settings.
What are the limitations of measuring oxygen partial pressure in the urine, and what can be done in response to lower declining values during the course of surgery that might reduce the incidence of acute kidney injury?
Well, firstly, there are definitely caveats in interpreting oxygen levels in the urine, oxygen partial pressure in the urine. A great example of this would be in the context of the use of loop diuretics. As you know, these block the use of oxygen and in the loop of Henle, and therefore there is a rise in the oxygen level in the medulla. And in fact, that leads to an increase in the numbers, presumably also in the urine. This should be contrasted with the evidence from a lot of sources that suggest that loop diuretics are nephrotoxins. And so there needs to be some context in interpreting the data from the urinary oxygen. In terms of what can be done in response to lower declining values of urinary oxygen levels during the course of surgery, one would hope that there would be interventions and that these interventions hopefully might even improve the well-being of the kidney. But frankly, we don't have a good understanding of what it is that improves oxygen partial pressure, either in the urine or in the kidney, let alone whether those things improve outcome for the kidney. That being said, we do need monitoring tools in order to guide the potential use of potentially protective interventions, lest we ever understand whether these lead subsequently to longer-term well-being of the kidney and reduced rates of AKI.
Is this new tool ready for widespread clinical use?
No. I think, as Dr. Sillerton acknowledged, there's still much to be known. Even though it's very appealing with the strong rationale for this to be a marker of well-being of the kidney in real time. So while I think the current study is a proof of concept for the technology, this needs to be followed up by more studies in the clinical setting to demonstrate its clinical value in predicting subsequent AKI and ultimately in potentially even guiding clinical management if there are recognized tools which might protect the kidney. But it's very early days. Maybe one day we might look at something like this as being the future ST segment to inform interventions, much as we use the ST segment itself to guide us when we're addressing myocardial ischemia. I think that's really where this holds the promise, but it requires a lot of buy-in from us, potentially as clinicians, but also from the research community to truly understand the potential value of urine oxygen levels.
Dr. Silverkin, what comes next for you and your research group? Specifically, what's the next step in validating use of oxygen partial pressure in the urine as a real-time monitor for the kidney?
Well, first off, I agree with what Dr. Stafford Smith has said. We have a lot of work ahead of us. The first thing we need to do is to better understand the relationship between low urine flow and the accuracy of our monitor. And to do that, we've started collaborating with some people who have large animal models to try to get at some of these answers. We also need to know how accurately urine oxygen measured this distally to the kidney, whether it reflects medullary oxygen or not. Again, this is something that we're planning to do in animal models. And then finally, just like Dr. Stafford Smith said, even if we can predict AKI, what can we do about it? What we need to know is not only what hemodynamic factors lead to medullary hypoxia during cardiac surgery, but what are interventions, if any, we can do to prevent that. I believe that comes with monitoring. So if we can first learn and have confidence in our ability to monitor renal injury in real time, then we can really start to get at these questions that we're talking about.
Terrific. I hope today's discussion will lead many of you listening to read this new article that appears in the September 2021 issue of Anesthesiology, where you can learn more about the use of oxygen partial pressure in the urine as a real-time monitor for the kidney. Dr. John Wanderer from Vanderbilt and I created an infographic that also appears in the same issue, and it's titled, Time for a New Monitor? Urine Oxygenation as a Measure of Acute Kidney Injury, where we explain the key findings of this new study. Dr. Silverton and Stafford Smith, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.